Maybe you're here because you've run out of something to binge watch on Netflix. Maybe you're here because you're trying to make sense of things. Whatever the reason, many have found themselves looking for answers to big questions.
This is a space for honest, non-judgmental chat about some of life's real issues. And while we don't have all the answers, we are happy to ask the question, what's God got to do with it?
Hi, I'm Alex.
And I'm Mark.
We are totally out of our depth and honestly winging it a little.
But you'll be relieved to know that we're drafting in experts each episode to help us out.
Well, John, thank you for joining us again. I hope the commute wasn't too difficult. So let's just dive right deep into the deep end. Today we're going to talk about loneliness. What would you say causes loneliness, and are some more susceptible to feeling lonely than others?
Well, loneliness is not necessarily the absence of people. I mean, you can be lonely and have a lot of people around you. Loneliness is more the absence of meaningful relationships over time. It also has to do with isolation and a feeling of worthlessness. I mean, loneliness and depression and anxiety are very closely connected. And yes, some people are much more prone to loneliness than others. Elderly people in particular are very prone to loneliness. People with certain forms of mental health challenges may feel isolated and stigmatized and alienated from community. People with disabilities, young mothers. There's a multitude. I mean, it's one of the big issues for our kind of society. So, yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's an issue that we've become more aware of recently, and probably taking it more seriously. I think it probably wasn't taken very seriously not very long ago. But what, in your experience, are the kind of physical, mental, spiritual effects of loneliness?
Well, loneliness is pretty devastating for all of these dimensions, for your relational life, for your psychological life. And also for your physical life, interestingly. I read this really interesting report the other day, and one of the areas I'm interested in is dementia. And this report was saying, it was in the British Journal of Psychiatry, I think. What they were saying is that people who are isolated and live alone are much more prone to developing dementia than people who are in community. And the reason for that being that in order for your brain to function and grow, you need people around you to relate to you. So in order for you to be able to speak, people have to speak to you. So if you've ever seen these kind of horrible situations where psychotic parents have locked a child in a cupboard for 9 months or whatever, and this child comes out and they can't speak. The reason they can't speak is because you need to be spoken to. But for that part of your brain to be stimulated and to grow. And it's the same for all of us. If we don't practice relationships, then there's aspects of our brain which are focused on relationships and language and so on and so forth, do tend to recline. Decline even. Mm-hmm. And so it can actually be a contributing factor to physical as well as psychological conditions. So it's a profoundly devastating experience, because human beings are intended to be relational creatures. We become who we are as we relate with one another. If we don't relate with one another, then we can very easily lose who we are.
Yeah, in your book, Dementia, Living in the Memories of God, you speak about something that struck me as very, very profound, actually, in the correlation between slowing down and loving one another, and how actually to relate to people who have different experiences of the world than we do, actually it requires us to slow down and sometimes just we're too busy to properly love people. How do you think that kind of thing might relate to how we deal with loneliness?
Well, there was a study done in Princeton, a theological seminary, back in 1970 some years ago. It was called the Good Samaritan study, right? Princeton Seminary is a really interesting place because they've got the seminary at one side and they've got a chapel at the other side. And to get to the chapel, you've got to go through this kind of tunnel thing. And the psychologists set up this experiment. And they put a guy in the tunnel who was pretending to be injured. And then they sent across the seminary, two groups of seminary students to the chapel to preach. The first group of students, they said to them, now you're late for chapel service, so you need to get across here. And the guys that were late rushed past this guy in the tunnel and into this chapel. The other guys said, you get plenty of time, take your time. They walked across and they ministered to this guy that they thought was injured. Now both groups were going to the chapel to preach on the Good Samaritan.
Irony.
The point being that if you're moving too quickly, you don't notice things and you don't notice people. And one of the problems for Western culture, really, in many ways, is that we move so quickly that we don't notice people who are marginalized or people who are vulnerable, people who are lonely, or whatever way that you want. So there's something profoundly important about recognizing that time is something that's gifted to us for a purpose. So there's a Japanese theologian called Kusaka Kiyama, who wrote a book a few years ago called The 3 Mile an Hour God. And in it, he was talking about, this is how it runs, really. Jesus, who in his incarnation, when he was a human being, walked at 3 miles an hour, because the average speed that human beings walk at is 3 miles an hour. So Jesus, who is God, walks at 3 miles an hour. Jesus, who is God, who is love, walks at 3 miles an hour. So love has a speed, and it's a slow speed. There's something profoundly important about that, because we're very, very busy people for the most of us. And this includes church people as well as everybody who's not necessarily involved with the faith. We're moving so quickly that you don't notice things. You've got other things to do, or you can pass it on to somebody else to do it. And it's very easy for that to happen in relation to lonely people, marginalized people, people who are elderly, people who are disabled, people who are living with dementia. It's very easy to just pass it on to somebody else and not really see it as significant. So,
yeah. Sorry. we put a huge amount of emphasis and a huge amount of pride on being busy as well. So I guess when it comes to actually relating to people who aren't busy, you're kind of creating a strange structure for them to live in.
That's like a cultural thing, but it's true, because the first thing you do when you meet anybody is you'll ask them what they do, and then you'll put them in a hierarchy according to what they do. And chances are, people who think well are up at the top of there, like doctors and bankers, accountants, whatever. And then you'll ask them, what's your week like? And you'll say, oh, I'm just busy, I'm doing this. Or you speak, and then you speak to somebody who's retired and say, oh, I'm more busy now than I was before. They say, I like to say to people, say, what are you doing this week? And they'll say, yeah, nothing much. Are you busy? Yeah, I'm busy. Just because you get that kind of strange, dissonant reaction from people, because it's unusual. But we seem to get our identity and our value from what we do. And I think that's a significant problem, particularly if you end up not being able to do it.
Yeah, I think that's probably true for both sides of the coin here. For those of us who ought to be looking out for the vulnerable and the lonely, we get our identity from being busy and doing things, and perhaps those of us who find ourselves maybe newly lonely and not busy, maybe have lost some of our identity. So how would you speak into that kind of, how do we find our identity properly?
Well, that's an interesting one again, because if you look at what the Apostle Paul says about your identity, he says you no longer are who you used to be. Now you find your identity in Christ. And so no matter what you do, no matter how well you do it, that doesn't make you who you are. That may make you more or less faithful to the tasks that are given to you. It doesn't make you who you are. Who you are is who you are in Christ. And what's even more weird about that is Paul says, in Colossians, I guess, that your identity is hidden in Christ. So you know who you are, but only to the extent that you know who you are. Only God knows who you really are. So, you know, that's really important if you think about it for people who are experiencing memory loss, because we very often think that you are what you remember. And that becomes really problematic if you can no longer remember things. But Paul says, no, you are not by who you remember, not by the story that you tell about yourself, but by the story that God tells about you. There's something really important about that, because you don't know yourself very well. Now, if you think about it, when I was before I became a Christian, I thought I was doing quite well in life. I thought I was quite a happy person, quite a decent person. Then I discovered Jesus, and I discovered that I'm a horrible fallen sinner, and that everything I thought I knew about myself actually turns out not to be quite as accurate as I thought. And I think it's an illustration that ultimately you put your faith in God, because God is the only one who knows you. And so I think that you find your identity in that way. But that's a very countercultural way of thinking about identity, because we do tend to construct our identity according to our own narratives, our own stories, and our own expectations. And that becomes really problematic if, for example, you retire. Because for some people, retirement can be absolutely devastating, because one day your identity is one thing as a bank manager or as a social worker, and the next day you're not, you're something else. Like, which is why you should apply, you should, it's a bit of advice for you, you should prepare for your retirement in your early 50s, apparently. I've got a friend that's a gerontologist. He says, if you don't prepare for your retirement, you'll wake up at 65 and you won't know who you are. And it's true.
That's so true. There's so many people, I think, like you said, there's so many different types of people that I think that brings a huge amount of comfort to knowing that who you are and your value isn't based on what you do, and it's not based on how many people you speak to in a day.
Right.
I definitely noticed a huge shift when I became a mum. You go from working every day and being needed in conversations at work and having a social life to suddenly what you're interacting with is someone that can't interact back with you.
Yeah.
And so it does bring into very sharp focus that everything that you, well, for me anyway, everything that you think of yourself, everything that gives you pride is kind of taken away. And there is something very comforting in knowing that you're loved and you're valued.
That's right.
Aside from that, aside from anything that you can do.
Absolutely. And I think just to tie that in with what we're talking about in terms of loneliness, is that your value, ultimately your value comes from God, obviously. But your experience of value comes from other people. I mean, because value is not something that you generate by yourself. Value is always a gift that's given to you by other people. You know, the value of a wedding ring isn't the metal that it's made of, it's what it means in that sense. The value of a friend is not the fact that you want this from them or you want that from them, it's the gift that they give to you. And one of the problems for people who live with loneliness or who live lonely lives is that nobody gives them the gift of value. So that, and if you can imagine being a 72-year-old person living on the top of a high-rise flat on your own, and you very rarely see anybody, where do you get your value from? Your feeling of value, your sense of value. So, no matter, of course, ultimately, God still values you, and you kind of know that yourself. But, you know, if you don't experience that in your relationships, it's very difficult to find self-value, which is why I suspect depression and loneliness are so closely connected.
Yeah, it's the loneliness epidemic was talked about before coronavirus, wasn't it? And it's
former epidemics changed meanings.
yeah. But it's something the church has really, I think, missed in terms of how we do sometimes value programs ahead of people.
That's right.
And I wonder if you've got any kind of practical advice for maybe how churches could go about better tackling the issue of loneliness.
Well, the key is to visit people. I mean, the key is to know the vulnerable people within your community that are liable to be alienated and feeling lonely and be prone to mental health and spiritual issues and all of these different things. So to have an awareness within your congregation, but also to have an awareness within your geographical location, because any church is responsible not just for the space that it inhabits on a Sunday, it's the whole community there is who you're responsible for. And so beginning to engage in what you might call the practices of noticing. You know, because something like 95% of what goes on within a human being is unnoticed. Like it's only about 5% or something that you cognate and think about it. Like. And we oftentimes live our lives because probably 95% of what goes on within your community you don't know about. And the 5% that you have is just your own little bit for your own. So developing a way of practicing noticing things that you wouldn't notice in other ways. So you can do that simply by read the newspaper, read the local newspaper, think about the stories that are there, think about the people that may be reflected in these stories that you're responsible for, think about ways in which you can simply offer space for friendship. Now you can't make people become friends, but you can offer spaces for friendship. Most churches have physical premises. If you create a space that's safe and open, then more than probably people will fill it.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you.
In light of who Jesus was and how he engaged with people, how can we cultivate a culture that prevents isolation from being as prevalent as it is?
Well, the way I think about it is nature of discipleship is the definition of friendship. So, you know, in John's Gospel, Paul says to his disciples, "I no longer call you servants, I call you friends." Right? That's a radical change of identity. We're talking about identity from servant to friendship with the living God. So, friendship. But when you think about the nature of Jesus' friendship, it's really, really interesting because, you know, the people that Jesus befriended were those in the marginal, those who are isolated and alienated from society, those who were excluded, those who were stigmatized, those who were rejected. Now, that's not the kind of friendship that most of us have within Western cultures. Because most of our friendship, maybe your friendship is the same, you can do the friendship test. Like, most of your friends look or think very similar to yourself. You'll read the same things, you'll have the same interests. And if you don't have the same interest, the chances are you'll probably fall out at some point. You won't be. So it's a really different model of friendship where like attracts like. Whereas with Jesus, and the principle of the incarnation is the same. God becomes a human being. God, who is radically other than human beings, becomes a human being and offers human beings friendships. That's something completely different, a different mode of friendship in that way. So I think reclaiming that idea of Christ-like friendship is really, really important. And also recognizing that when we talk about Jesus being with the marginalized or being on the margins, that's not strictly true. Because Jesus, who is God, sits with those whom society marginalized and shifts the margins. And the danger for churches is that they can be over there in the same way as the temple was, doing the revolutions, doing the worship, doing this kind of stuff, whereas God's over here doing something different. So, just be careful that we locate ourselves with God would be my general comment on that. And friendship is one way of doing it. Just like friendship is one way of doing that.
Absolutely. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for giving us your time and slowing down to our pace to answer some of our questions on loneliness.
No, thank you for the invitation. I hope it works out well for you.
We really hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast today. I hope that what we've discussed has been helpful and enjoyable. And if anything has struck a chord with you, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Link into some of the other materials that we publish on our website on hebron-evangelical.co.uk. Or if you want to just chat, give me an email, community@hebronaberdeen.org.uk. We look forward to next podcast, where again we'll be tackling another topic and asking, what's God got to do with it?